From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 13th installment in a conversation that we've been having with Professor Luciana Bone about the political economy of the USSR from the time of the revolution in 1917 through 1991. And when we last spoke, we were discussing Italian fascism, and we're going to pick up there, I think, was the plan, and also look at the various forms of fascism that arose, particularly in Europe. I guess fascism with national characteristics, to use the language of the Chinese Communist Party.
Very good. Good morning, Don.
Good morning. How are you, Luciana?
So, I'll start today with sort of reviewing what we have done. So, really, this portion of our history of the Russian Revolution, or the political economy of the Russian Revolution, has been stuck in its opposite, in fascism, in a discussion of the rise of fascism. I wouldn't say stuck, but you know, we've been discussing fascism as the other, as the opposite of socialism.
Right.
So, and the purpose of this was to ask what exactly is fascism, what are its features, how do we recognize the signs of its coming, when it's here, and this, of course, looks to the question now in the United States, whether we do or do not have fascism, or what degree of it, whether we need it, whether it's here, whether it's coming, etc. Okay?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, so the reason why we studied Italian fascism, while we discussed Italian fascism so far, is to be able to compare and contrast fascism, Italian fascism with other fascist regimes to arrive at a possibly informed definition of the varieties of its expression. So we have traced in Italian fascism the following aspects so far. Number one, the repression of communism and socialism, therefore, of the idea of class struggle, of organized labor, of workers' parties and movements, social revolution and progress, and social progress. Two, we identify the contempt for liberal democracy as weak and ineffectual.
Mm-hmm.
This is interesting because because fascism does not reject the idea, the principle of private property.
Right.
The contempt for liberal democracy that the fascists express is, I think, because liberal democracy is not accomplishing much for the economic elite ruling class.
Right.
Okay, so, and the fascist, Italian fascism at least, had a demagogic profession, professed itself to be anti-capitalist, but since it did not reject private property, that's why I call it demagogic.
Right.
And we identified in Italian fascism also a racist component. Very early on, the anti-Slav component. Later on, much later on, in the 30s, during the African campaigns, let's call them imperialism, you know, anti-African, prejudice, and eventually when the alliance with Hitler was formed, specifically in the Spanish Civil War, then we have anti-Jewish racial law. So
right. Even
in Italian fascism, which at least in the popular mind doesn't seem to have racism up front, like the Nazis. And here it's worth to consider the difference between Protestant and Catholic cultures. Mm. The phenomenon of... I wrote about this in Counterpoint, and I'll mention it some other time.
No, maybe a quick reference, because it's an interesting point. To me...
Yeah,
you know,
go ahead.
You mentioned the fact... I mean, this is the historical fact. You look at the rise of fascism, and it's in tandem with the rising threat to the power and position of the bourgeoisie that was represented with a successful socialist revolution in Russia,
right?
And the development of contradictions, you know, all the way through the Great Depression, throughout the rest of the capitalist world, that put regime change on the agenda, you know, and class-based regime change. And so as fascism attempted to essentially compete for the loyalties of the working class and or middle class, or in any event to at least divide and or negate the threat from those quarters, what it looked to do was to substitute for the idea of class membership in some other group that quote-unquote transcended class, maybe to use the terminology of 2008, a post-class society, where in Germany the form it took was, you know, the German Volk concept, that as a German I have more in common, a German worker, I have more in common with the German factory owner than I have with, say, a Lithuanian or Slavic co-worker on the assembly line. My loyalty lies with, you know, across the class divide, with others of my nationality. And this is the kind of, you know, substitution phenomenon, basically, that is emblematic of fascism. So we're kind of talking about that in a way.
Yeah, that's right. Another feature of Italian fascism was the support of powerful economic interests by segments of the ruling class, such as the industrialists and landowners. The sixth was a cult of muscular and militarist masculinity as the active element in society. Italian fascism relegated to women the confinement to the family and the procreative function. So that's six. We have seven. Seven aspect was the glorification of some grandeur in the past. In Italy, Mussolini. For Mussolini, was the Roman Empire,
right. A
golden age which fascism promises to restore,
right.
Sort of make Italy great again,
right.
And which requires. You know, which requires war and imperialism. And all this in Italy was proposed with the rhetoric of populism, of caring for the ordinary man. Let's get beyond politics and let's get down to what really matters, you, the people. But at the same time, the financing, you know, was not by the ordinary man, but by his boss.
Right.
Now, I want to emphasize, too, that, as will be obvious to listeners, that these features were all absent from the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution and from its creation, the Socialist Soviet Union. I mean, as we recall, the Soviet Union was a workers' and peasant state, not an industrialist and landowner's state.
Right. That's right.
It had abolished private property and the economic system of capitalism. It had abolished inequality among the national people, of the former Tsarist Empire. It had been internationalist rather than imperialist. It came to be supported by workers and peasants. It had granted women equality, access to education, jobs, self-sufficiency, and access to public health. It had not sought to reestablish some mythical past, but worked to secure a future of well-being for all the citizens. Yep. It had worked for disarmament and peace. Now, how is it possible to equate fascism and communism?
They're clearly opposites.
As is popular today.
Yep.
It just boggles the mind.
Yes, it does. They're clearly opposites. On each of the points that you just listed, they're you know, there's a dialectic there. I mean, this is in contradiction to that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, you know, the two are as different as Mr. Hyde and Dr. Jekyll. But yet we continue to get this, really, it's even in the school textbooks in secondary school. Mm-hmm. The two are equivalent.
Hey, you know what? There's another point. We stumbled on this towards the end of our last conversation also. There's another point of contradiction that shows this, and that is the way power is attained. You know, when they obfuscate to try to show this false equivalency, they characterize fascism as riding into power on the back of a wave of populism. But as we discussed and noted last time we spoke, in fact, in Italy, Mussolini became prime minister because Victor Emmanuel III, the king, appointed him. And in Germany, Hitler came to power because von Hindenburg appointed him as chancellor and then handed over all state power to the chancellor's office. This was not riding on the wave of populism into office, but rather blunting of any rising populism by the existing power elite, by putting their boy in power to manage the crisis.
Yes, and the same thing happened in Austria.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was somebody handing over the reins to the fascist. It's the wave of populism that comes with the propaganda afterwards.
Right. That's right.
So, you know, I'm saying it ironically, the wave of populism being this man of the people. That's a myth. It completely manufactured. And it shows you that political power is not what runs the country. It's the economics that runs political power.
That's right.
But anyway, looking back, we can say today that when capitalism finds resistance to its imperative to exploit, it goes into a panic. For that is how profits are maximized. When capitalism finds resistance to the imperative to exploit, it goes into a panic. I think we have such a thing in America today, and I will explain briefly in this next phrase. The resistance to exploitation, which we do not yet have here at home in the United States, you know, we don't have a working class uprising, an organized working, though we have sentiments of discontent,
right,
which will mature.
Right.
But so resistance to exploitation, which we do not yet have here active in the U.S., but we have it abroad. And resistance to exploitation is what panics the American establishment today, in addition to competition from other economies. But the examples of resistance to U.S. exploitation today is not yet threatening enough at home, but it is the struggles against colonization in places like Syria and Venezuela. I think that these two I would call them defeats for the time being. Certainly Syria is a tremendous setback.
Mm-hmm.
And Venezuela so far is too, though they will try something else.
Mm.
So it's not only what used to be in the 20s, the threat to the established order at home that, you know, brought fascism to the fore then in Europe. There was a threat at home immediately. But as the United States is an imperialist nation and wants to accomplish its task of dominating the world, then the resistance abroad is causing this crisis between the liberals and whatever Trump represents in the United States now. It's
yep.
the imperial project that is stymied that can point to a necessity for a strong man. And I think that would be the military.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, well, first of all, let's look at the classic Marxist analysis of capitalism, which is essentially that it must, as it develops, both broaden and deepen its exploitation, or it dies. In other words, it has to grow or die. And you reach, you know, various crises of overproduction and others and the, you know, assembling of this Megillah over time.
Yeah, declining rate of profit, yeah.
But you finally reach an end game. That's what Marx predicted. And Lenin rightly brought this, you know, to the international stage, looking at imperialism, that, you know, after you have managed to own every inch of the domestic economy, now you have to own the rest of the planet. And so you go out and you start warring over resources and markets abroad. Somebody finally, you know, becomes top of the heap. And once they get there, now they have this same, you know, crisis at some point looming that, okay, we've got everything, but we need more, but there is no more. And so you get to that point, you know, you could argue that, the U.S., having become the hegemonic power, certainly since 1991, was getting close to that point. You've seen some real crises like the 2007-2008 one that hit the U.S. and Europe where, you know, it's kind of a crisis of, well, there was a class war. They won. Now what? Because there's almost no mechanism for infusing like Keynesian stimulus into the economy anymore. When the last time they did it by letting people borrow against their accumulated assets, they've lost all their assets now. So there's nothing there but a lot of pay. You know, there's a lot of fundamental problems. When somebody turns around and says, not only can you not continue to expand internationally, but we want to roll it back, that provokes a crisis at the very center of the system.
Yes. Yes. And that's right. And so that's where we're at. The failure by the liberal establishment, both, you know, both Republican and Democratic, to deliver what they promised with the neocon launching of the Iraq war, for example. The whole thing is a mess.
Right.
The neocon project is in shambles.
Yes.
You know, the neocons had one way of doing it. They failed, and Obama had the CIA, and that, you know, and that
right.
failed.
Right.
So both branches, both parties have failed to secure the world.
Right. And no one's resolved this contradiction, which, of course, you know, if you believe Marx and Lenin, can't be resolved without a revolutionary change.
Mm-hmm. That's it. And now, if revolutionary change, even if it happens, and, you know, it happens outside, to begin with, the resistance is outside the United States,
right.
then you have to say, look, we need to control the national people whose resources are declining,
right.
and they're getting less and less, and they're going to be in the streets. So we have to have something stronger.
Right.
And the fact that the liberal establishment is so incensed is a sign that they know they're in trouble.
Yep. Yeah, that's the parallel. You know, you have all these people on the left, or ostensibly on the left, pointing to their favorite really is 1932, 1933. They're not that savvy on Mussolini. They prefer Hitler. But, you know, they keep pointing to this as historical analogy. You know, they're very sloppy with the way they present the facts from it. But the fact is, at the kernel of it, this condition, the rise of fascism that came in response to the threat to the capitalist system posed by just the existence of the Soviet Union, that condition is kind of, you know, in full maturity almost at this point. And so they got to know, as they see the end days for their reign on the calendar, we got to figure out something that'll work like fascism did 80 years ago.
That's right. That's right. So this leads us to the question of, you know, right, what is... We have two possibilities now. Both, you know, the possibility that the choice to control politics will be fascism, but then we also know that within fascism, the fascism is pregnant with revolution.
Right, that's right.
So it's really a critical moment here, and we really need to be savvy about how, whom we call a fascist, what we call fascist, you know, what is the real, where is the real threat? And I think that the liberal establishment is fighting for its life.
Mm, agreed.
And, you know, so I return to my outline and ask the question, but did all fascism between the two, all fascisms between the two world wars look the same? You know, were they the same? Well, in some aspects, they were the same. And primarily in the hatred of the 1917 revolution. I think the 1917 revolution is the 20th century.
Yep.
Everything that happened in the 20th century was the result of that.
Yep.
Eric Hobsbawm, I mean, there was a conversation between Eric Hobsbawm, the English historian of empire, and Edward Said, and they asked each other what was the key date of the 20th century. And Eric Hobsbawm said 1917, and Edward Said said 1917, both for different reasons. Eric Hobsbawm said because of the Russian Revolution or Bolshevik Revolution. Edward Said said because of the Balfour Declaration and the assignation of Palestine to the Jewish people. I think that eventually, you know, we can talk about that, how I tend to agree with Hobsbawm, but I've examined, you know, Said's response to, but anyway, I thought that those, so I reiterate that 1917 was the key to the 20th century.
Right.
And the 1917 revolution was simply an insult to the bourgeois world because it survived. It had an economic success and social, and made social progress. So that's what all the European fascism had in common, and I will name them later. They were all born in the wake of the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution.
Right.
They were all terrified of its reproduction in states throughout Europe. They all feared and repudiated the Marxist class struggle. And the question is, what threat does the United States face? Well, one is China, you know, becoming a second economy. Well, China is a second economy, but it probably will surpass the American economy. Mm-hmm. And the other is, and I reiterate, the inability to accomplish its task to conquer the world, which is tied up with China. So, you know, do we have a threat to the existing capitalist order in the United States? Yes, I think we do. It's not the same as it was in the 30s and 20s, but it has a different character.
Right.
But it is the same in a way.
Yeah.
So the example of the Russian Revolution spread like fire throughout Europe and Asia between 1917 and 1924 and inspired world communist movements. We had three German revolutions between 1919 and 1924.
Right.
We had the Bavarian Soviet Republic. We had the Hungarian right. Revolution. We had the Red Biennium in Italy. There were protests, uprisings, and strikes constantly. There was the Rand Rebellion of white miners in South Africa. There was the September Uprising in Bulgaria. There was the August Uprising in Georgia, the Mongolian Revolution, the Chinese Civil War. Do you see?
Really?
I mean, it was something to years that shook the world.
Absolutely true.
Yeah. So the ideas of the Russian Revolution were not a failure. And though all these revolutions were put down, the ideas of the Bolshevik Revolution were a success among the masses. And this threatened the existing order. So fascism was given the charge to kill these ideas. But although fascisms that followed in the wake of the failed revolutions of 1917 and 24, and again between 1931 and 36, which was in Austria, Portugal, and Spain, although all fascism were anti-communist, they didn't share some of the features of Italian fascism. And this was because of the different historical conditions and precedents. In Austria, unlike in Italy, the prime mover was the Catholic Church.
Right. And this is the kind of thing, this goes to the heart of the thesis, basically, that you're presenting.
I beg your pardon?
This goes to the heart of the thesis that you're presenting, which we'll have to get to next week, and that is that fascism takes individual characteristics based on the historical and other material conditions in the society in which it comes to fruition. And we're going to start with a look at some of that next week. And I thank you very much, Luciana, for your time again
this week. Thank you again, Don. Pleasure to be with you. And I thank your listeners.
And I'm glad you're feeling better, by the way. We missed out on Luciana last week because she had a little bug and she's all better now.
Thank you. All better.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.